The Orlando shooting is raising questions about whether the lessons from the Boston Marathon bombings were learned. Massachusetts Congressman William Keating, who's a member of the Homeland Security Committee, reviewed security after the marathon bombings, and he found some shortcomings, particularly in the communication among law enforcement about bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who the FBI investigated before the bombings but then closed the case on Tsarnaev. The committee issued a report about a year later and made several recommendations that were designed to improve security. We got in touch with Congressman Keating, and we started by asking him about the briefing he received yesterday regarding the Orlando shooting and the information that the shooter, Omar Mateen's wife, may have been involved.
Well, we're restricted in terms of what we can do in terms of speaking on classified parts. So what I'll do is comment on the things that have become public, and that, in fact, has become public. There's information that she had an awareness of what he was doing. There's been information in the public venue where she had been driving him around. There's also been information that surfaced that he had gone to Disney World, as well as going to the Pulse nightclub, so that I would suspect that there's possible charges that could be brought against his wife. Mm-hmm. Yet the public indications are that she's cooperating.
The Orlando attack is being compared to the Boston Marathon bombings. In both cases, attackers were known to the FBI at some point, and yet were still able to commit this type of violence. In Omar Mateen's case, investigated by the FBI for 10 months because of comments he made, apparently threatening violence. And after the marathon bombings, you were part of the group that spent a year reviewing security and what happened. And your group determined several things after that year. Among them, it found weaknesses in communication about security issues and problems with information sharing between federal and local law enforcement. So this Orlando incident raises the question, has anything changed since the marathon bombings in terms of security, and were the steps taken that were supposed to be taken here?
Yeah, the investigation took place in 2013 and the interview in 2014. So that was before we finished with our analysis, before it became public in 2013.
The investigation of Omar Mateen. I just want to make sure that's clear.
No, the interview that he had. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it's important, and it's one of my personal, and I think it's shared with the members of the Homeland Security Committee, that we want to find out how much information was shared. How far did it go down with law enforcement? There was communication with law enforcement, but how far did that go? And how far, in terms of cooperation during that period, did they deal with local people to get information? One of the big issues that I feel has to be addressed is this. In our report after the Boston Marathon bombing, one of the difficulties is you have to end, you know, the investigation at a certain point. When that ends, we paraphrase this as case closed. All the information gets shut off from other authorities. And one of the questions that I want to pursue, and maybe if it's necessary, bring legislation forth on, is even when these cases are closed, if someone's on the watch list, which he was on, shouldn't there be some kind of alarm or trigger, even when the case is closed, when he is purchasing weapons, right, and assault weapons? To me, it would be very important that somehow those investigators, even with the case closed, had that information that he was purchasing guns about a week before this.
There's a lot of debate about that, and the National Rifle Association is saying that this isn't about guns, that perhaps this man should have been investigated for the violent comments that he made, that the FBI investigated, and there should have been a thorough investigation of that.
It's very easy to look in hindsight, and I don't take the attitude, and I don't think our committee does, in trying to undertake these investigations to assess blame, but to find out what was missed and what could happen. That's the way it should be approached, not the way the NRA leader was saying it should be approached. And the other thing that I think is just inescapable is this. Our greatest danger still is with the lone wolves, people that are Americans that are already here, that have become radicalized. They don't have to go over the borders. They know how to assimilate into scenes and can penetrate undetected because they know how to move in, move out of crowds without raising suspicion.
Congressman William Keating, member of the Homeland Security Committee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Governor Charlie Baker has taken his first steps toward shaping the future of Massachusetts' highest court. He's named three Superior Court judges to the state Supreme Judicial Court. WBUR's Steve Brown has more on the appointments as well as reaction to the governor's choices.
Governor Baker calls judges Kimberly Budd, Frank Gaziano, and David Lowy extremely distinguished and experienced jurists. The governor selected the three from a pool of roughly 40 applicants to fill seats that will be vacated this summer by Justices Robert Cordy, Francis Spina, and Fernan Duffley. With two more vacancies expected next year, the governor will have appointed a majority of the seven SJC members a little more than midway through his first term. The governor had high praise for his three nominees.
Our nominees, Judges Budd, Gaziano, and Lowy, have all demonstrated measured and fair temperament and outstanding legal knowledge and skills throughout their careers. In presiding over the most complicated civil and criminal matters for the Commonwealth citizens in our superior courts, they have demonstrated every day that they are judges of the highest caliber and character.
Judge Kimberly Budd was appointed to the Superior Court in 2009 by former Democratic Governor Deval Patrick. The daughter of former U.S. Attorney Wayne Budd graduated from Harvard Law School in 1991. She has served as an attorney with a prestigious Boston law firm, as well as in the U.S. Attorney's Office. In accepting the nomination, Budd thanked the governor for appointing her.
I look forward to appearing before the governor's council, and I hope that they see fit to confirm my nomination. If confirmed, the people of the Commonwealth can be assured that I shall work very hard to carry out and fulfill my duties and responsibilities as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court.
As a prosecutor, Frank Gaziano was a member of the legal team that obtained a death sentence for killer Gary Lee Sampson. That sentence was ultimately overturned. As Superior Court judge since 2004, Gaziano presided over high-profile trials, including one for Christian Carl Gerhardstreiter, a con man who had operated under the name Clark Rockefeller and was convicted of kidnapping his own daughter. Gaziano said he was honored to be selected for the state's highest court.
It is truly humbling to be nominated to a court whose mission is to preserve everybody's individual liberties in this state, to promote fairness among our citizens, to make sure that litigants have impartial trials, and to accommodate the rule of law.
David Lowy has been a judge for 19 years, first in district court and since 2001, Superior Court. Before being elevated to the bench, Lowy was an assistant DA and also served as a deputy legal counsel to former Governor William Weld. Lowy said all four of his grandparents came to this country seeking opportunity and freedom from oppression and prejudice.
I am keenly aware of how few people have been provided the opportunities that I have had since birth. Empathy, humility, and reverence for the law will guide me every day if I am confirmed.
The appointments are being praised by some members of the legal community. Martin Healy, chief legal counsel for the Massachusetts Bar Association, says Governor Baker has come out with a strong opening statement on where he is headed for the court system.
All three of them have stellar backgrounds, and they're known as moderate, fair judges and very intellectually based judges. So I think the governor has set a high standard for his future appointments, and I think that particularly the legal community, knowing these three individuals, is very excited by having them elevated to the highest court.
Healy says Baker's picks will move the court toward a more centrist position.
I know over the last 15 to 20 years or so when I began in legal practice, it was a very conservative court, and it drifted more leftward over the past two decades. I see these three individuals as being moderates. They're not partisan by any means, and they don't display any partisanship, but just in their previous actions as judges and their decisions and the way they've conducted themselves shows me, and I think the bar generally, that they're going to be moderate to, you know, leaning more to the right than the left.
The three nominees must be confirmed by the elected eight-member Governor's Council before they can assume their new posts. All three have faced nomination hearings in the past, and barring anything unforeseen, will likely be confirmed and seated by the time the new court term begins in September. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Steve Brown at the State House.
In a commercial building near Boston Medical Center, there's a room that has a collection of armchairs, reclining wheelchairs, and a small sofa. The nine seats in the room are often full, especially in the middle of the day. The room may be the only place in the country where patients can ride out a high from heroin or other drugs under medical supervision. The room is known as SPOT, a supportive place for observation and treatment. Boston Healthcare for the Homeless opened it 7 weeks ago. As WBUR's Martha Biebinger reports, the room is like a living lab full of surprises.
They arrive on their own, worried about what was really in that bag of heroin. Some are carried in, slumped between two friends. Others are lifted off the sidewalk or asphalt of a nearby alley and rolled to the room in a clinic wheelchair.
It's a safe place to be.
Tommy, who's 39, has been using heroin for at least 21 years. He's looking for jobs and housing, and we've agreed not to use his full name.
It's a lot safer than being out there on the street, possibly walking in the traffic. It's a possibility I might OD if I was alone out there.
About 15 people a day are coming to what was the conference room at the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program. If the person can speak, a nurse will ask what they took before helping them into a reclining chair, wrapping a blood pressure cuff around one arm, and placing an oxygen monitor over a finger. Dr. Jesse Gaeta is the program's medical director.
The monitors are really convenient because it takes a lot of the guessing out of understanding how far someone is into an overdose syndrome.
That phrase, overdose syndrome, is new. Gaeta made it up to describe what's happening to patients in this room. They are not going through a typical opioid overdose.
A classic opiate overdose is characterized by a person who stops breathing. They have central nervous system depression, so it's mostly respiratory depression and respiratory arrest.
But that's not the problem Gaeta sees on the monitors connected to about 75% of her SPOT room patients.
What we're seeing in this room as we're watching this happen progressively is more depression of heart rates and blood pressures as actually the primary, sometimes the only, abnormalities.
Gaeta says her patients may start the day with heroin or another opioid, and then a few hours later take pills that will enhance or extend the high. So the overdoses she sees are the result of pills that lower blood pressure or reduce anxiety or treat nausea and seizures or often all of the above.
People are talking about that a lot here, about the layering of this cocktail of medications. And that's really reflected in the vital signs that we're seeing, which is not indicative of pure opiate overdoses. And I'm not sure we've seen that without doing this kind of monitoring.
This is just a snapshot based on 129 patients who've used this room so far. About half of them repeat visitors. But signs of an overdose cocktail are reflected in state overdose death reports. Gaeta says her staff realized, as they watched blood pressure levels drop, that they had to bring in IV fluid equipment to boost many patients' blood pressure. It's just one of the adjustments doctors and nurses in the SPOT room are making as they find out what is really happening inside addiction patients who look like they are falling into a deep sleep. Here's another surprise.
What you see subjectively looking at someone and what their vital signs are don't always match up.
Nurse April Donahue says some patients in the room appear so sedated that they do not respond when she speaks loudly in their ear or raps on their sternum.
So we have people that are difficult to wake up to that point that still have rock-solid vital signs, better than mine.
Donahue says if she was not watching these vital signs, she'd be racing to inject naloxone, brand name Narcan, the drug that flushes opioids out of the nervous system. But naloxone may not be what many of these patients need. And, says Gaeta, they hate it.
People sort of wake up vomiting, extremely agitated, sometimes sort of hallucinating, maybe having bowel movement in the moment. It's not pretty. So people don't want Narcan to be used on them unless it's absolutely necessary. I mean, they also don't want to die.
Boston Healthcare for the Homeless used naloxone on 5 patients in just one day in April, the Friday before this room opened. But Gaeta and the nurses have only given it to 4 patients in the 7 weeks since. Instead, they're using lots of oxygen from big green tanks they roll over to each patient, inserting nasal tubes to keep patients at a normal breathing rate. Patients given naloxone often bolt from a clinic or emergency room in search of more drugs. A person who comes off a high more naturally may be more open to talking about their substance use, going into treatment, or getting tested for HIV, hep C, or other medical problems.
I think the thing that has struck me the most is the gratitude.
Donahue says addiction patients do not want to have to hide their drug use in an alley or fast food bathroom.
Just to get out of that environment, even if it's for a little while, to get off the street and to be cared for. I mean, so many of our participants don't have anyone that's caring for them.
It's one reason Tommy is becoming a repeat client. He's on methadone, which helps him stay off opioids some days and plow through another of the books he loves. Today, he has a copy of the Essential Hunter S. Thompson collection with a broken black spine tucked under one arm.
This is just a start, and I think it's a great start. I mean, it's going to slow down a lot of overdoses, and I think it could save a lot of lives, and it will save a lot of lives in the long run.
Including Tommy's. He went into respiratory failure a few weeks ago in the room and was brought back with naloxone. Boston police and the mayor's office say they have not had any reports of problems related to this room where addiction patients can ride out a high under medical supervision. Boston Healthcare for the Homeless is conducting surveys of the immediate area to look for evidence of increased or decreased drug use. Those results will be out in the early fall. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
A new kind of water contamination is showing up across the United States, including in New England. It's not lead, as was the case in Flint, Michigan. Instead, it's a chemical used to manufacture everything from Teflon pans to firefighting foam. It's forced some communities to hand out bottled water and shut down their water systems. Although companies stopped using this chemical because of potential health risks, a new replacement chemical is also causing concerns. From the New England News Collaborative and New Hampshire Public Radio, Emily Corrin reports.
If you're thirsty or need to boil pasta, or even if you want to give water to the kids' pet ladybugs here at Tracy Carl's house in Merrimack, you better use bottled water.
These are 5 gallons. We go through 5 gallons or 4 gallons.
That's every 3 days for Tracy Carl's family of eight.
We do sometimes drink out of the filtered water from the fridge, which I still don't trust completely.
The Carl's water comes from wells that contain C8s, a family of toxic chemicals used until recently at a plastics plant nearby. The specific C8 chemical in this case is called PFOA. Anyway, studies funded by a 2005 lawsuit settlement with chemical maker DuPont have shown these chemicals may cause problems like high cholesterol, kidney cancer, and thyroid disease. The good news is American companies aren't using them anymore, including Saint-Gobain, a $50 billion plastics company with a plant 2.5 miles from Tracy Carl's house. Like I said, that's the good news. The bad news is we know even less about the chemical substitutes which replace the C8s. Inside Saint-Gobain's Merrimack plastics plant, enormous looms weave fabric from giant spools of glass thread. Tom Kniske takes me around. He's the CEO of Saint-Gobain's plastics division.
We did the Dallas Cowboys Stadium roof, the Denver Airport roof.
These fabrics are also used for hazmat suits and military tents. They're incredibly slippery and impervious even to biological warfare. Deeper into the plant, I see 25 square foot tubs of something that looks like paint. It's called PTFE. This is the coating that gives the fabric that frictionless, repels everything quality. It's the same stuff used on nonstick cookware. Up until 2015, that coating contained C8s. That's when U.S. companies voluntarily stopped using the chemical, including Saint-Gobain. So what exactly is in this stuff? I ask Kniske.
That's confidential between the suppliers.
This is common. More than 20% of all chemicals known to the EPA have confidential names and formulas, including, evidently, this one. But despite that confidentiality agreement, Saint-Gobain has told New Hampshire's environmental regulator what kind of chemical the replacement is.
It was replaced with the C6 compound.
This is Mike Fitzgerald. He specializes in air quality for the state. He says the C8 chemicals, which are fluorocarbons with 8 carbons, have been replaced with C6s, fluorocarbons with 6 carbons.
You're satisfied that the replacement chemical is safe?
Well, certainly to the extent that we know. We're certainly relying on EPA to ensure that
they've all been approved by the EPA.
That's Tom Kaniski again from St. Gobain. But approved isn't the right word here. While many of the replacements have been inventoried by EPA, chemicals don't have to pass any particular safety measures to make it onto that list. For that, you can blame Congress. They wrote the law that governs EPA's chemical rules. It hasn't been updated in 40 years. But are these replacement chemicals regulated?
They were rigorously studied. They're regulated materials, unlike what PFOA was.
Also, not quite right. Rather, the EPA has allowed businesses to use C6s while companies do their own testing on things like how the chemicals degrade over time and whether they're toxic. St. Gobain and other companies seem confident in their safety. But in the meantime, the EPA tells us by email it is still reviewing the C6s, and it considers them to be, quote, capable of producing reproductive, developmental, and systemic effects in laboratory tests.
What we really don't know is what kinds of damage they do and at which levels.
Philippe Grandjean is at the forefront of research on both C8s and their replacements at Harvard University. And for the most part, he says, we don't know much about the original contaminants, and we know even less about the replacements.
The best advice I can give is let's treat them as if they have similar toxic properties as C8. That's the best I can say at this point.
Back in Merrimack, Tracy Carl tells me industry oversight is not working.
They always ask for forgiveness after the fact rather than do the research first.
She says she's worried the whole C8 water crisis will just become a C6 water crisis next year. For New England News Collaborative, I'm Emily Corwin in New Hampshire.